Even from high orbit, Gedi Prime had looked dark and forbidding, like an infected sore. But Caladan, home of the legendary Duke Atreides, mortal enemy of the Harkonnens, seemed like a sapphire sparkling with a blaze of sunlight. After everything that had happened to him, it still seemed impossible that the surly and treacherous woman, Janice Milam, had actually been true to her word. She had rescued him for her own petty reasons, her own spiteful revenge. But that did not matter to Duncan. He was here. It had been worse than a nightmare, which he relived in the brooding days as the Highliner journeyed from system to system in a roundabout way to Caladan. In the darkness of Forest Guard Station, as he had approached the mysterious flitterthopter, the woman had snatched Duncan, gripping tightly before he could defend himself. The young boy had reacted with fear and frantic struggles, but Janice yanked his arm, breaking open the hardened new skin he'd placed over the deep cut in his shoulder. With surprising strength, the dusky-skinned woman hauled him inside the small flitter and sealed the entry hatch. Yowling like a wild animal, Duncan thrashed and clawed, trying to writhe away from her grip. He pounded on the curved hatch, desperate to get out, to run once again into the night filled with armed hunters. But instead, the flitter's door remained locked. Panting, Janice released the boy, tossed her chocolate hair, and glared at him. "If you don't stop it right now, Idaho, I'm going to dump you in the laps of those Harkonnen hunters." Turning away from him with disdain, she powered up the flitter's engines. Duncan could feel an ominous hum travel through the small craft, vibrating through the seat and floor. He crouched back against the wall. "You've already betrayed me to the Harkonnens. You were the one who made those men take my parents and murder them. You're the reason I had to train so hard and why they're hunting me now. I know what you did." "Yeah, well, things have changed." She raised a dusky hand in a meaningless gesture, turning toward the piloting controls. "I'm not helping Harkonnens anymore, not after what they did to me." Indignant, Duncan clenched his fists at his sides. Blood from the reopened wound seeped onto his tattered shirt. "What they did to you?" He couldn't imagine anything that even approached the anguish he and his family had endured. "You wouldn't understand. You're just a youngster. Another one of their pawns." Janice smiled as she raised the flitter up off the ground. "But through you, I can get back at them." Duncan sneered. "Maybe I'm just a boy, but I spent all night beating the Harkonnens at their hunting game. I watched Raban kill my mother and father. Who knows what else they've done to my uncles, aunts, and cousins?" "I doubt there's anyone left alive on Gedi Prime with the name of Idaho, especially after the embarrassment you caused them tonight. Tough luck." "If they did that, it was a waste of effort," he said, trying to hide the pain. "I didn't know my relatives anyway." Janice increased the flitter's speed, boosting them low across the dark trees and away from the wilderness preserve. "Right now I'm helping you get away from the hunters, so just shut up and be glad. You don't have any other options." She ran the craft without lights, keeping her engines masked, though Duncan couldn't imagine how they could ever escape from prying Harkonnen eyes. He had killed several of the hunters, and worse, he had outwitted and humiliated Raban. Duncan allowed himself the slightest satisfied smile. Coming forward, he slumped exhausted into a seat beside Janice, who had strapped herself into the pilot's chair. "Why should I trust you?" "Did I ask you to trust me?" She flashed a dark-eyed glance at him. "Just take advantage of the situation." "Are you going to tell me anything?" Janice flew in silence for a long moment, racing over the bunched treetops before she answered. "It's true. Yeah, I reported your parents to the Harkonnens. I'd heard rumors. Knew your mother and father had done something to get the officials angry. and the Harkonnens don't like people who make them angry. I was looking out for myself and saw an advantage. By turning them in, I thought I might get a reward. Besides, your parents caused the problem themselves in the first place. They made the mistakes. I was just trying to cash in on it. Nothing personal. Somebody else would have done it if I hadn't. Duncan scowled, clenching his grimy hands. He wished he had the nerve to use his knife on this woman, but that would cause the flitter to crash. She was his only way out. For now. Her face contorted into an angry grimace. But what did the Harkonnens give me in return? A reward? A promotion? No, nothing. A kick in the teeth. Not even a thank you very much. A troubled look crossed her face, disappearing as quickly as a tiny cloud scudding across the sun. It's not easy to do something like that, you know. You think I enjoyed it? But on Gedi Prime, opportunities arise rarely enough, and I'd watched too many of them pass me by. This should have really changed things for me. But when I approached them to ask for the slightest bit of consideration, they threw me out and ordered me not to come back again. It was all for nothing, and that makes it even worse. Her nostrils flared. Nobody does that to Janice Milam without risking plenty. So you're not doing this for me at all, Duncan said. Not because you feel guilty about what you did and all the pain you caused people. You just want to get even with the Harkonnens. Hey, kid, just take your breaks where you can get them. Duncan rummaged in one of the storage compartments until he found 2 fruit rice bars and a sealed bubble of juice. Without asking, he tore into the packets and began stuffing himself. The bars tasted only faintly of cinnamon, a flavor enhancer to simulate melange. You're welcome, Janice said sarcastically. He didn't reply, chewed loudly. All night long the flitter soared over the lowlands toward the forbidding city of Barony. For a moment, Duncan thought she intended to dump him back into prison, where he would have to go through everything all over again. He slipped his hand into his pocket, felt the handle of his dull knife. But Janice flew the unmarked craft beyond the prison complex and headed south, past a dozen cities and villages. They had stopped for a day, hiding out during the afternoon, replenishing their supplies at a small way station. Janice provided him with a blue single suit, cleaned up his wound as best she could, and crudely administered medical treatment. She tended him with no special care, but merely expressed the hope that he would not draw attention to himself. At dusk, they set off again, heading far south to an independent spaceport. Duncan didn't know the names of the places they visited, nor did he ask. No one had ever taught him geography. Whenever he bothered to venture a question, Janice invariably snapped at him or ignored him entirely. The spaceport complex carried a flavor of rough mercantile personnel and the guild, rather than the cumbersome Harkonnen style. It was functional and efficient, with endurance emphasized over luxury or eye appeal. Corridors and rooms were large enough for the movement of enclosed tanks holding guild navigators. Janice parked the flitterthopter where she could easily retrieve it, then set her own hot-wired security systems before leaving the craft behind. "Follow me," she said. With young Duncan in tow, she marched out into the bustle and chaos of the spaceport. "I've made some arrangements, but if you get lost here, I'm not looking for you." "Why shouldn't I just run? I don't trust you." "I'm going to put you on a ship that'll take you away from Gedi Prime, far from the Harkonnens." She looked down at him, goading. "Your choice, kid. I don't need any more trouble from you." Duncan clenched his teeth and followed her without further comment. Janice tracked down a battered cargo craft swarming with workers who loaded scuffed cases on board. Using suspensor pads, they dragged heavy pallets into the holding bay and stacked them haphazardly. "Second mate of this ship is an old friend of mine," Janice said. "He owes me a favor." Duncan did not ask what kind of people a woman like Janice Milam would consider friends, or what she had done to earn herself such a favor. "I'm not going to pay a single salary for your passage, Idaho. Your family has already cost my conscience enough, ruined my standing with the Harkonnen overlords, and got me nothing. But my friend Reno says you can ride in the hold, just as long as you don't eat anything other than standard rations or cost anyone time or credits." Duncan watched the spaceport activities around him. He had no real conception of what life would be like on any other world. The cargo ship looked old and unimpressive. But if it provided him with passage away from Gedi Prime, then it was a golden bird from heaven. Janice took him roughly by his arm and marched him toward the loading ramp. His sore shoulder throbbed. "They're hauling recyclable materials and other salvage, which they'll take to a processing station on Caladan. That's the home of House Atreides, archenemies of the Harkonnens. You know about the feud between those houses?" When Duncan shook his head, Janice laughed. "Of course not. How would a little dirt rodent like you have learned anything about the Landsrat and the Great Houses?" She stopped one of the workers guiding a precariously loaded suspensor platform. "Where's Reno? Tell him Janice Milam is here, and I want to see him right away." She glanced down at Duncan, who stood up straight and tried to look presentable. "Tell him I brought the package I promised." Touching a communicator on his lapel, the man mumbled something into it. Then, without acknowledging Janice, he pushed his load up into the squat cargo hauler. Duncan waited, analyzing the activity around him, while Janice frowned and fidgeted. Before long, a grubby-looking man emerged, his skin smeared with colored lubricants, grime, and oily sweat. "Reno," Janice waved to him, "it's about damn time." He gave her a tight embrace, followed by a long and wet kiss. Janice broke away as quickly as she could and pointed to Duncan. "There he is. Take him to Caladan." She smiled. "I can't think of a better revenge than to deliver this boy right where they least want him to be, and where they're least likely to find him." "You play dangerous games, Janice," Reno said. "I enjoy games." She balled her fist and playfully punched him in the shoulder. "Don't tell anyone." Reno raised his eyebrows. "What's the point of coming back to this scummy port if you're not here waiting for me? Who'd keep me company in a dark and lonely bunk? No, it wouldn't be worth my while to turn you in. But you still owe me." Before going, Janice knelt and fixed her eyes on young Duncan Idaho. She seemed to be trying for some semblance of compassion. "Look, kid, here's what I want you to do. When you get to Caladan, step off that ship and insist on seeing Duke Paulus Atreides himself. Duke Atreides. Tell him you've come from the Harkonnens and demand to be taken into service in his household." Reno's eyebrows shot high on his forehead, and he muttered something unintelligible. Janice kept her face firm and intent, thinking to play a last cruel joke on the boy she had betrayed. She realized there would be no chance whatsoever that a dirty, nameless street urchin could possibly set foot in the grand hall of Castle Caladan. But that wouldn't stop him from trying. Maybe for years. She'd already had her victory by stealing the boy from Ravan's hunting party. She had known they were taking Duncan to the forest guard station, and so she made a particular effort to find him, to snatch him away and turn him over to the Harkonnen's greatest enemies. Whatever else happened to the boy was now irrelevant to her, but Janice amused herself by imagining all the tribulations Duncan Idaho would undergo before finally giving up. "Come on," Reno said gruffly, pulling Duncan's arm. I'll find you a place in the cargo hold where you can sleep and hide. Duncan didn't look back at Janice. He wondered if she expected him to say goodbye or thank her for what she'd done. But he refused to do that. She hadn't helped him because she cared, or even out of remorse. No, he wouldn't demean himself. And he could never forgive Janice for her part in destroying his family. Strange woman. He walked up the ramp, looking straight ahead, not knowing where he was going. Lost and parentless, without any idea of what he would do next, Duncan, Idaho, headed off. Renault gave him no comfort and little nourishment, but at least he left the boy in peace. What Duncan, Idaho, needed most in the entire universe was time to recover. A few days to sort out his memories and learn to live with the ones he could not forget. He slept alone like a rat in the cargo hold of the battered transport, surrounded by scrap metal and recyclables. None of it was soft, but he still slept well enough on the rust-smelling floor, with his back against a cold bulkhead. It was the most peaceful time he'd had in recent memory. Finally, when the ship descended toward Caladan to deliver its load and dump him alone and friendless on a strange world, Duncan was ready for anything. He had his drive and his energy. Nothing would sway him from his chosen quest. Now he just had to find Duke Paulus Atreides. History allows us to see the obvious. But, unfortunately, not until it is too late. Prince Rafael Corino. When he surveyed Leto's bedraggled black hair, his dust-smeared clothes, and the perspiration streaks down his cheeks, Romber actually chuckled. He meant no insult by his response, but seemed incapable of believing the preposterous story Leto had told. He stood back and assessed his friend. Vermilion hell! Don't you think you're, overreacting a bit, Leto? Romber strode over to one of the broad windows. Alcoves all along the wall of the stocky prince's room displayed hand-picked geological oddities, his delight and pride. Far beyond the amenities of his station as the Earl's son, Romber found joy in his collection of minerals, crystals, and gems. He could have purchased more magnificent specimens many times over, but the prince had personally found each rock in his own explorations of cave floors and small tunnels. But in all his explorations, Romber, indeed the entire Vernius ruling family, had been blind to the unrest among the workers. Now Leto understood why the old duke had insisted that his son learn to read his subjects and know the mood of the populace. "At the heart of it all, lad, we rule at their sufferance," Paulus had told him, "though, thankfully, most of the population doesn't realize it. If you're a good enough ruler, none of your people will think to question it." As if embarrassed by Leto's dramatic news and rumpled appearance, the tousle-haired young man peered down at the swirling masses of workers in the production yards below. Everything seemed quiet. Business as usual. "Leto, Leto!" He pointed a pudgy finger at the apparently content lower classes who labored like dutiful drones. "Subboids can't even decide for themselves what to eat for dinner, much less band together and start a rebellion. That takes too much initiative." Leto shook his head, still panting. His sweaty hair clung to his forehead. He felt more shaky now that he was safe, sitting slumped in a comfortable self-forming chair in Romber's private quarters. When he'd been fleeing for his life, he had reacted on instinct alone. Now, trying to relax, he couldn't keep his pulse from racing. He took a long gulp of sour cidrit juice from a goblet on Romber's breakfast tray. "I'm only reporting what I saw, Romber, and I don't imagine threats. I've seen enough real ones to know the difference." He leaned forward, his gray eyes flashing at his friend. "I tell you, something's going on. The Suboids were talking about overthrowing House Vernius, tearing down what you've built, and taking Ix for themselves. They were preparing for violence." Romber hesitated, as if still waiting to hear the punchline. "Well, I'll tell my father. You can give him your version of the events, and I'm sure he'll look into the matter." Leto's shoulders sagged. "What if Earl Vernius ignored the problem until it was too late?" Romber brushed down his purple tunic and smiled, then scratched his head in perplexity. It seemed to take great stamina for him to address the subject again. He appeared genuinely baffled. "But if you've been down there, Leto, you see that we take care of the Suboids. They're given food, shelter, families, jobs. Sure, maybe we take the lion's share of the profits. That's the way of things. That's our society. But we don't abuse our workers. What can they possibly complain about?"
"Maybe they see it differently," Leto said. "Physical oppression isn't the only kind of abuse."
Romber brightened, then extended his hand. "Come, my friend. This might just make an interesting twist for our political lectures today. We can use it as a hypothetical case." Leto followed, more saddened than distraught. He was afraid the Ixians would never see this trouble as anything more than an interesting political discussion. From the tallest spire of the Grand Palais, Earl Dominic Vernius ruled an industrial empire hidden from outside view. The big man paced back and forth on the transparent floor of his orb office that hung like a magnificent crystal ball from the cavern ceiling. The office walls and floor were constructed of perfectly bonded Ixian glass, with no seams or distortions. He seemed to be walking on air, floating over his domain. At times Dominic felt like a deity on high, gazing out upon his universe. He ran a calloused palm across his smooth, newly shaven head. The skin still tingled there from the invigorating lotions Shando used when she massaged his scalp. His daughter, Kylea, sat in a suspensor chair and watched him. He approved of her taking an interest in Ixian business, but today he felt too troubled to spend much time debating with her. He brushed imaginary crumbs off his newly laundered sleeveless tunic, turned about, and circled his quicksilver desk again. Kylea continued to study him, offering no advice, though his daughter understood the problem they faced. Dominic didn't expect old Rudy to roll over and meekly accept the loss of tax revenues caused by the new Ixian highliner design. No, the Emperor would find some way to twist a simple business decision into a personal affront. But Dominic had no idea how the retaliation would come, or where it would strike. Elrood had always been unpredictable.
"You just have to stay one step ahead of him," Kylea said. "You're good at that."
She thought of the wily way her father had stolen the Emperor's concubine right out from under his nose, and how Elrood had never forgotten the fact. The slightest touch of resentment darkened her words. She would rather have grown up on marvelous Kytane instead of here, under the ground. "I can't stay ahead of him if I don't know which direction he's moving," Dominic replied. The Ixian Earl seemed to be floating upside down, with the solid rock ceiling and the spires of the Grand Palais above his head, and only open air beneath his feet. Kylea straightened the lace on her gown, adjusted the trim, and bent as she studied shipping records and compared manifests again, hoping to determine a better pattern for distributing Ixian technology. Dominic didn't expect her to do better than his experts, but he let her have her fun. Her idea to send out Ixian self-learning fighting mechs to a few black market dealers had been a stroke of genius.
He paused a moment for a wistful smile that made his long mustache sink into the seams around his mouth. His daughter was stunningly beautiful, a work of art in every way, made to be an ornament in some great lord's household. But she was sharp-witted, too. Kailia was a strange mixture, all right, fascinated by court games and styles and everything to do with the grandeur of Kaitane, but also doggedly determined to comprehend the workings of House Vernius. Even at her age, she understood that behind-the-scenes business complexities were a woman's real key to power in the Imperium, unless she joined the Bene Gesserit. Dominic didn't think his daughter understood Shando's decision to leave the Imperial Court and come with him to Ix. Why would the lover of the most powerful man in the universe leave all that splendor to marry a weather-beaten war hero who lived in a city underground? At times Dominic wondered the same thing, but his love for Shando knew no bounds, and his wife often told him she had never regretted her decision. Kailia offered a stark contrast with her mother in all but appearance. The young woman couldn't possibly be comfortable in her extravagant clothes and finery, yet she wore her best at all times, as if afraid she might miss an opportunity. Perhaps she resented the lost chances in her life, and would rather be warded off to a sponsor in the Imperial Palace. He'd noticed that she toyed with the affections of the twin sons of Ambassador Pilru, as if marriage to one of them might tie her to the embassy on Kaitane. But Kater and Demur Pilru were scheduled to test for positions in the Spacing Guild, and if they passed the examination, they would be off-planet within a week. At any rate, Dominic was sure he could arrange a much more profitable match for his only female child. Perhaps even to Leto Atreides. A Kamai blinked yellow on the wall, interrupting his thoughts. An important message. An update of the troubling rumors that had spread like poison through a cistern. Yes, he said. Without being asked, Kailia walked across the invisible floor and stood next to him to read the report as it imaged itself on the quicksilver surface of his desk. Her emerald eyes narrowed as she read the words. The smell of his daughter's faint perfume and the glitter of combs in her dark bronze hair brought a paternal smile to his face. Such a young lady. Such a young businesswoman. "Are you sure you want to concern yourself with this child?" he asked, wishing to shelter her from the grim news. Labor relations were so much more complex than technological innovations. Kailia just looked at him in annoyance that he would even ask the question. He read more details on what he had been told earlier in the day, though he still couldn't quite believe everything Leto Atreides claimed he'd heard and seen. A disturbance was brewing in the deep-ground manufacturing facilities, where the suboid workers had begun complaining. An unprecedented situation. Kailia took a deep breath, marshaling her thoughts. If the suboids have such grievances, why haven't they elected a spokesman? Why haven't they delivered any formal demands? Oh, they're just grumbling, child. They claim they're being forced to assemble machines in violation of the Butlerian Jihad, and they don't want to perform blasphemous labor. The message screen went dark after they finished reading the summary report, and Kailia stood up, hands on her hips. Her skirts rustled as she huffed. Wherever do they get such ridiculous ideas? How can they even begin to understand the nuances and complexities of running these operations? They were bred and trained in Ixion facilities. Who put those thoughts in their minds? Dominic shook his gleaming head and realized his daughter had raised a very good question. You're right. Suboids certainly couldn't come up with such extrapolations on their own. Kailia continued to be indignant. Don't they realize how much we give them? How much we provide and how much it costs? I've looked at the costs and benefits. The suboids don't know how good they have it compared to workers on other planets. She shook her head, and her curved mouth bent downward in a frown. She looked through the floor at her feet, to the manufactories in the cavern far below. Maybe they should visit Gedi Prime. Or Arrakis. Then they wouldn't complain about Ix. But Dominic wouldn't let go of her first thread of conversation. Suboids are bred for limited intelligence, only enough to perform assigned tasks. And they're supposed to do it without complaining. It's part of their mental makeup. He joined his daughter in staring down at the floor of the grotto, which swarmed with highliner construction workers. Could our bio designers have overlooked something important? Do the suboids have a point? The definition of machine minds encompasses a broad range, but there might be gray areas. Kylia shook her head and tapped her crystal pad. Our mentats and legal advisors are meticulous about the precise strictures of the jihad, and our quality control methods are effective. We're on solid ground, and they can prove every assertion we make. Dominic chewed his lower lip. The suboids couldn't possibly have specifics, since there aren't any violations. At least we haven't knowingly stepped over the line. Not in any instance. Kylia studied her father, then looked down at the bustling work area again. Maybe you should have Captain Jaws and a team of inspectors turn over every stone, investigate every aspect of our design and manufacturing processes, prove to the suboids that their complaints are groundless. Dominic considered the idea. Of course, I don't want to be too hard on the workers. I want no crackdowns, and certainly no revolts. The suboids are to be treated well, as always. He met her gaze, and she seemed very much an adult. Yes, Kylia said, her voice hardening. They work better that way. Like the knowledge of your own being, the Siege forms a firm base from which you move out into the world and into the universe. Freeman teaching. Pardit Kynes was so fascinated by the Freeman culture, religion, and daily routine that he remained completely oblivious to the life and death debate raging around him in the Siege. Naib Hainar had told him he could talk to the people and describe his ideas. And so he talked, at every opportunity. For an entire cycle of the moons, the Freemen whispered their opinions in small caves and dens, or shouted them across tables in private meetings of the Siege elders. Some of them even empathized with what the strange outworlder was saying. Though his fate remained undecided, Kynes didn't slow for a moment. Siege guides took him around and showed him many things they thought would interest him. But the planetologist also stopped to ask questions of women working in the stillsuit factories, of old men tending water supplies, and of withered grandmothers operating solar ovens or filing rough burrs off scrap metal. The bustling activity around the sealed caves astonished him. Some workers trampled spice residue to extract fuel. Others curded spice for fermentation. Weavers at power looms used their own hair, the long fur of mutated rats, wisps of desert cotton, and even skin strips from wild creatures to make their durable fabric. And, of course, schools taught the young freemen desert skills, as well as ruthless combat techniques. One morning, Kynes awoke refreshed, perfectly comfortable after spending the night on a mat on the hard floor. Throughout much of his life, he had slept in the open on rough ground. His body could find rest just about anywhere. He breakfasted on dehydrated fruits and dry cakes the Freeman women had baked in thermal ovens. The beginnings of a beard covered his face, a sandy stubble. A young woman named Freeth brought him a serving tray with meticulously prepared spice coffee in an ornate pot. During the entire ritual, she directed her deep blue eyes downward, as she had done every morning since Kynes's arrival at the Siege. He hadn't thought anything of her cool, efficient attentions until someone had whispered to him,
"She is the unmarried sister of Stilgar, whose life you saved against the Harkonnen dogs."
Freeth had fine features and smooth, tanned skin. Her hair appeared long enough to flow to her waist, if ever she undid it from her water rings and let it fall. Her manner was quiet but all-knowing, in the Freeman way. She rushed to fulfill every small wish Kynes bothered to express, often without his realizing it. He might have noticed how beautiful she was, had he not been so intent on noticing everything else around him. After he had sipped his pungent, cardamom-laced coffee down to the dregs, Kynes hauled out his electronic pad to jot down notes and ideas. At a noise, he looked up to see wiry young Turok standing in the doorway. "I'm to take you anywhere you wish, planetologist, so long as you remain within Redwall Siege." Kynes nodded and smiled, disregarding the constraints of being a captive. They did not rankle him. It was understood that he would never leave the Siege alive unless the Freeman accepted him and decided to trust him completely. If he did join the community, there could be no secrets between them. On the other hand, if the Freeman chose to execute him in the end, there would have been no point in keeping secrets from a dead man. Previously, Kynes had seen the tunnels, the food storage chambers, the guarded water supplies, even the Huanhui death stills. In fascination, he had watched the family groups of desert-hardened men, each with his several wives. He had seen them pray to Shai Hulud. He'd begun to compile a mental sketch of this culture and the political and familial ties within the Siege. But it would take decades to unravel all the subtle relationships, all the nuances of obligations laid down upon their kinsmen many generations earlier. "I'd like to go to the top of the rock," he said, remembering his duties as Imperial planetologist. "If we could retrieve some of the equipment from my ground car, I presume you've kept it safe, I'd like to establish a weather station here. It's imperative that we collect climate data, temperature variations, atmospheric humidity, and wind patterns, from as many isolated spots as possible." Turok looked at him, surprised and disbelieving. Then he shrugged. "As you wish, planetologist." Knowing the conservative ways of the Siege elders, Turok was pessimistic about the fate of this enthusiastic but not terribly bright man. What a futile effort it would be for Kynes to continue his vigorous work. But if it kept him happy in his last days... "Come," Turok said, "put on your stillsuit." "Oh, we'll only be out for a few minutes." Turok scowled at him, looking stern and much older. "A breath of moisture is water wasted into the air. We are not so rich we can afford to waste water." Shrugging, Kynes pulled on his crinkling, slick-surfaced uniform and took the time to attach all the seals, though he did so clumsily. Heaving a heavy sigh, Turok assisted him, explaining the most effective way to dress out the suit and adjust the fittings to optimize its efficiency. "You have bought a decent stillsuit. It is a Freeman manufacture," the young man observed. "In this, at least, you have chosen well." Kynes followed Turok to the storage chamber where his ground car had been kept. The Freeman had stripped it of amenities, and his equipment lay in open boxes on the cave floor, inspected and catalogued. No doubt the Siege inhabitants had been trying to determine how they could put these things to use. "They're still planning to kill me," Kynes thought. "Haven't they heard a thing I've said?" Oddly, the thought neither depressed nor frightened him. He simply took the knowledge as a challenge. He was not about to give up. There was too much left to do. He would have to make them understand. Among the clutter, he found his weather apparatus and tucked the components under his arms, but made no comment about what had been done to his possessions. He knew Freeman had a communal mentality. Every item owned by an individual was owned by the entire community. Since he had spent so much of his life alone, relying only on himself and his abilities, he found it difficult to absorb such a mindset. Chirok did not offer to carry any of the equipment, but led the way up steep steps that had been rough-hewn into the stone wall. Kynes panted, but did not complain. Ahead of him, the guide shifted aside numerous barricades, moisture baffles, and door seals. Chirok flashed glances over his shoulder to make sure the planetologist was keeping up, then increased his speed. Finally, they emerged from a cleft atop the rubble-strewn peaks. The young freeman leaned back in the shadow of the rocks, keeping himself cool, while Kynes stepped out into open sunlight. All around them, the stone was coppery brown with a few discolorations of lichen. A good sign, he thought. The advanced footprints of biological systems. As he stared out at the sweeping vista of the Great Basin, he saw dunes that were the grayish white and brown of newly decomposed rock grains, as well as the buttery yellow of older oxidized sand. From the sandworms he'd seen, as well as the teeming sand plankton in the spice-rich sands, Kynes knew that dune already had the basis for a complex ecosystem. He was certain it would take only a few crucial nudges in the proper direction to make this dormant place blossom. The Freeman people could do it. "Imperial man," said Turok, stepping forward from the shade. "What is it you see when you stare out onto the desert like that?" Kynes answered without looking at him. "I see limitless possibilities." In a sealed chamber deep in the Siege, Wizened Hynar sat at the head of a stone table, glaring with his single eye. Trying to remain apart from the debate, the Siege Naib watched the council elders shout at each other. "We know the man's loyalty," said one old man, Jareth. "He works for the Imperium. You've seen his dossier. He's on Dune as a guest of the Harkonnens." Jareth had a silver ring in his left earlobe, a treasure taken from a smuggler he'd killed in a duel. "That means nothing," said another elder, Aliyid. "As freemen, do we not don other clothes, other masks, and pretend to fit in? It's a means of survival when circumstances require it. You, of all people, should know not to judge someone solely on appearances." Garna, a weary-looking, long-haired elder, rested his pointed chin on his knuckles. "I'm most incensed at those three young idiots, what they did after the planetologist helped them defeat the Harkonnen Bravos. Any straight-thinking adult would have shrugged and sent the man's shade to join those of the six dead vermin on the ground. With some regret, of course, but still it should have been done." He sighed. "These are inexperienced youths, poorly trained. They should never have been left alone in the desert." Hynar flared his nostrils. "You cannot fault their thinking, Garna. There was the moral obligation. Pardat Kynes had saved their lives. Even brash young men such as those three realized the water burden that had been placed on them." "But what of their obligations to Redwall Siege and our people?" long-haired Garna insisted. "Does a debt owed to a mere imperial servant outweigh their loyalty to us?" "The question isn't about the boys," Aliyid interrupted. "Amum, Turok, and Stilgard did what they thought was best. We are now left to decide about this planetologist and his fate." "He's a madman," the first elder, Jareth, said. "Have you heard him talk? He wants trees, open water, irrigation, crops. He envisions a verdant planet instead of desert." A snort, then a toying with the ring in his ear. "He's mad, I say.